Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And we're here with another of our virtual events. And it's a real pleasure to have Matt Goldman with us, albeit virtually. We'd love to have him back in person. You've been, I think, for almost all of your books, you've been here in person.
Yes.
Yeah. Matt's going to be talking about his brand new book, Carolina Moonset. And we've made it a selection of one of our clubs and completely sold out of the hardcover. So what do you say there, Barbara? It's a good lesson to be learned about get in there on these clubs fast, right? Because we do sell out.
Absolutely, because we can't do an unlimited number of books. And so, you know, when they sell out, most of the time now, they're gone.
Right. And but they've done a simultaneous hardcover and trade paperback. And this is a really beautiful cover design. Matt, are you happy with it?
I'm thrilled with that cover design.
Yeah.
I have loved all my covers with Forge, and they really did a wonderful job on this book.
Right.
Yeah.
So everybody watching, if you have questions for Matt, you know, as they occur to you, just go ahead and put them in the chat feature or comment feature on YouTube and Facebook. And Barbara usually brings me back on screen towards the end of the hour. I'll be happy to ask any questions you might have. So I feel like Lester Holt over here, but Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's wonderful to see you, Matt. I'm so sorry you're not here, but then again, it's 100 and something. So
yeah.
Are you home in Minnesota? Or are you down?
I'm in Minnesota right now. Yeah.
Oh, well, see, it's the flip side of the year.
Yes, I know. I got to start having them release my books in January.
Exactly.
So I can come and get some nice weather.
We'd rather be in Minnesota, but in January, we'd rather be here. So we first met Matt when his wonderful Neil Shapiro Private Eye series, and I loved his first book because it had the most wonderful premise for defying forensic investigation. Do you want to remind us, Matt, what it was?
Yeah, the book is called Gone to Dust, and the crime scene is somewhat unusual because both the body and most of the house are covered from the contents of vacuum cleaner bags, hundreds of vacuum cleaner bags, and all that dust and dirt and fiber and DNA samples in there have contaminated the crime scene so badly that forensics can do nothing. They really have to sit on their hands, and that's why the police department feels it's necessary to bring on a consultant, and that's how I introduced my PI, Neil Shapiro, in that book. Yeah.
And what's his background, Matt?
Nils?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a Minneapolis police cadet, and he was laid off right after they graduated. And that really happened in Minneapolis. And everyone knew they would be hired as police officers within a few months. But Nils decided not to wait, and he got his PI license. And he, like a lot of PIs, he's more of a go-it-alone kind of person anyway. And so he went on and made his career as a private investigator after being trained by the police.
Well, I mean, it's true that he has fewer resources if he's not in the police department, but he's more autonomous. So it's
yes.
A trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah. And in real life, the police and private investigators can have a symbiotic relationship and help each other out from time to time. So the more private investigators and police officers I talked to, I learned about that.
So Matt went on to write, actually, Broken Ice, The Shallows, and Dead West. And now he's done something completely different, and I have to say that I missed it. I didn't even see it when it came out. Because originally, didn't this publish in May?
May 31st, yes.
Right. So greatly to my amazement, I suddenly discovered a book by Matt Goldman called Carolina Moonset, which didn't look anything like a Neil Shapiro book. And I thought, What has happened here? because I love Matt and his writing, I thought, well, you know, hot dog. So I picked it up to read it. And it is a really wonderful story. And there is crime in it. But that's not really the thrust of the story. So I'm interested in why you decided to write something so different.
Well, my publisher asked me to.
Okay.
I think that's from talking to my author friends. A lot of these series now go three or four, And they wanted me to write a standalone, and I was excited to write a standalone. And so that's why I took a shot at this. And you know, in this book, Joey Green, who's a middle-aged guy who lives in Chicago, goes to visit his parents who've retired to Beaufort, South Carolina. And he's really going to help his mom because his dad suffers from Lewy body dementia. And I know about that because my dad suffered from it. I don't claim to be an expert on it, but I think I wrote my dad fairly accurately. The character of Marshall Green is different than my dad, but the disease is exactly the same. And so, you know, my dad lost his short-term memory, and he was a talker. He was always wanting to talk about something. But when he couldn't talk about the weather or politics or sports or what he had for lunch, he started telling stories from his childhood and stories from my childhood, things I had never heard before. It was actually a nice silver lining to his dementia that because he could always remember me and my kids and everything about his childhood in great detail. And, you know, after he passed away, the writer in me thought, well, what if a character had that disease and started talking about a story they didn't know about that could bring up a family mystery? And that's really the seed of Carolina Moonset.
Wow, I didn't realize that it sprang from your own life. Is it Robin Williams said Lewy body dementia?
He did.
That's why he eventually committed suicide, because yeah, he didn't want to ride that whole thing out all the way through. And it's a neurological disease, right?
Yeah, it often presents as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, but when they get the diagnosis right, it's one thing, Lewy body disease, yes. Sometimes called Lewy body dementia or Lewy body disease. So, and I've heard a lot from the community of people who have someone with dementia in their family or healthcare professionals, and they've really responded positively to the book.
Well, I thought you wrote it wonderfully well, with great sensitivity. But I also think that the relationship that Joey encounters, because the parents sort of want to fix them up, and that's usually the kiss of death, right? But Joey is divorced and in his 40s, and he meets a woman who he's sort of compelled to meet, a woman who's 40 and divorced. And I thought that you handled that whole thread of the story so well. I mean, they live in different cities. She's from Boston, right? He's from Chicago. She has a career. She has children that are established there. He has his career and children. And what is it they're facing? But because they are engaged in what turns out to be this investigation and so forth in Beaufort, they get to know each other. And and so eventually they're able to build a relationship. And I thought you did that really brilliantly.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I wanted, well, you know, that comes a little bit from my life as well on two fronts. One, when I was in my 40s, I was single. And my parents were constantly trying to fix me up with somebody. And when I'd go down and visit them, because they lived in Beaufort, they retired there. And they would always mention people they knew who had people my age visiting their parents. And that's kind of where that came from. I also wanted to give Joey a partner as this family mystery came up, somebody with whom he could investigate. And I don't think it gives too much away to say when they're kind of set up on a first date, Leela, who's a psychologist, has this plan. She said, since we're only going to be here a week and then we're going to go our separate ways, rather than present the best part of ourselves. And in a normal situation, if we started dating, you know, 6 months down the line, we'd get tired of that and show each other our true selves. Let's just tell each other the worst things about ourselves right now and see if we want to spend any more time together this week. And that was kind of a fun way to kick off those two meeting each other. And spending some time together.
Well, I agree. You did set up the sort of classic ticking clock you know, which powers a lot of thrillers. But in this case, it has to do with whether they have time to explore their relationship. But they both have a great sense of humor. And I think, you know, neither one of them is bitter, which I think helps a lot because people who are so angry from their previous marriages. That can be so toxic, it spoils everything. But they seem to have reached some accommodation, each one of them, to what happened.
Yeah, they've both been single for a while. They've both dated for a while. So when they meet someone they click with, it's significant to them.
Now, I have spent time in Beaufort, but it was a really long time ago, back in the late 70s and early 80s when I lived in Virginia. We used to take the kids to Hilton Head for part of their summer break. This was before Hilton Head became way so developed. It was a lot smaller paradise and a lot less populated. Lovely. And part of that was always the fun of driving from Hilton Head down to Savannah, which is a wonderful city. And to do that, you would go through Beaufort, South Carolina, which I am here to tell you was the speed trap of the United States. That was where their revenue came from, was they were ready for the tourists, and it was. So, you know, anybody that had gone through Beaufort more than once knew the score. And, you know, so I remember that. I remember the harbor because, you know, it had lots of, I'm sure, probably much more like mega yachts now, but in those days, more modest boats. And I can remember that area sort of dripping with, what's the, you know,
the Spanish moss.
Spanish moss that, you know, so Beaufort was a kind of a sleepy, older, southern, you know, town. And I have a horrible feeling that just like Hilton did, it's probably not like that anymore.
Part of it still is that way. It has definitely grown. And I've been going there my whole life. It's one of the reasons I set the book there. I do know it a little bit. My mother's side of the family, when they came to this country, settled in Beaufort. So I have family going back a lot of generations. And it has definitely grown, but they have also done a good job, I think, of preserving some of the architecture and the places there. When the Northern Army came through, I don't know exactly why, but I know they burned a lot of towns, but they did not touch Beaufort. So there's a lot of antebellum charm still there. Buildings going back to the 1700s, in fact.
Well, I know that Hilton Head, to its credit, maintained even then a very, very strict building code. It was like, you know, even McDonald's didn't have golden arches. It all had to look like. And I wondered if Beaufort, had taken the same path and, you know, tried to protect its architectural heritage and not let people come in and, you know, blow it all.
Yeah, I mean, there are more, I mean, not every building looks like, they're not all built up on those pylons for hurricane waters to go under, but they have preserved a lot of it. A lot of it is still there. Those big old oaks with the moss in them are there, the palm trees everywhere. And it's on the, Beaufort itself is not on the ocean like Hilton Head is. It's on the intracoastal waterway, and it's full of tidal creeks and all sorts of water. You're always looking across water and marshland. And both of the Carolinas are beautiful places.
Well, they are. I know marshland is a big thing. In fact, Savannah's, you know, it is a port, but it's not an ocean port. Savannah is up, what is it, like 40 miles upriver or something?
Yes.
And I remember one occasion we were there, we were up on the bluff, you know, looking down on the river, because there the old docks and the old wharves were down on the water, but there was a lot of more recent stuff up on the bluffs. And we looked down the river towards the ocean going down, and along came this beautiful ship in full rigging. I mean, beautiful sailing ship. And there were people all up in the rigging, up in the masts and so forth. It was an amazing sight. And it turned out that this was the Coast Guard training ship. I'm trying to remember the name of it. And these were all Coast Guard cadets that were, you know, and it was just, it was such a drop back into the past, you know, to see this wonderful ship under full sail with people in the rigging and all sailing upriver towards Savannah. And, you know, it's not that often that you get a real bygone sense, but I thought that particular day we really did.
Yeah. Yeah. It is beautiful. And Savannah's close, which is another nice feature there.
It is. So yeah. What's the central mystery of the story? You've got, he comes down there because he thinks his mom needs help caring for his dad.
His mom just needs a break as a caregiver. And so she has been invited to play in a pickleball tournament in Florida. And Joey convinces her, go have fun for a few days. I can watch dad. And, you know, part of the theme of this book is that time in your life where the child becomes the parent. His dad can get confused easily. He gets disoriented. So he's really not allowed to leave the house without somebody because he can get lost. So Joey's got him for a few days. And I set up a kind of an old family rivalry with another family in town. And though Joey's dad was gone for a long time, he came back to Beaufort to retire, he still has a lot of bad feelings toward the Hammond family. And one night, because as we've mentioned, there's a little romance introduced in the story, and Joey is next door visiting Leela, and he kind of falls asleep there, and he goes back home and checks on his dad. His dad's fine. But very early that morning, they hear sirens, and this, you know, the patriarch of this Hammond family is found shot to death just a block away. And Joey's not exactly sure that his dad was locked in the house the whole time. And his dad keeps a pistol that he'd always take fishing when he was out on the water, just in case they got a shark in the boat and and this is just based on personal knowledge. There was concern about boat thieves at one time, because you're out on the water, you're on a sandbar, anybody could come and take your boat. So he has this pistol, but now Joey can't find the pistol, and he doesn't know if his dad was involved in this murder. And this present day murder ties to some stories his father's been telling about the past and some family friends. And so there's a 50-year-old murder and a present day murder. And Joey's trying to figure out how or if they're connected, and if his father, who he's known his whole life, is maybe a different person than Joey thought his dad was.
What you've done essentially is not created an unreliable narrator, but an unreliable actor.
Yes.
I think is really very clever, because, you know, the unreliable narrator has become something of a staple in psychological suspense, whether it's somebody suffering from amnesia or somebody who's been in a car wreck or somebody who's just a habitual liar or running a con or, you know, whatever it all is. But the reader, you know, in the Golden Age books, the reader generally, with a few exceptions, deliberate exceptions, was supposed to trust the narrator of the book, you know, trust them to be telling you the truth. And in fact, in older books, you were also able to trust the police, which is, you know, that all got blown away too. And now oftentimes, corrupt cops and corrupt politicians are a real staple of crime fiction, but didn't used to be that way in a simpler era. I mean, I don't know, the January 6th hearings are probably going to, you know, exacerbate all this as we move along, discovering the actual crimes that were committed by people you wouldn't have thought, you know, would do that. But anyway, I thought the fact that not only does Joey not know for sure what his dad did, but there's no clear evidence that his dad would know what his dad did.
No, that's true, especially with the recent murder, because his dad really can't remember things. And I saw that with my own dad. He didn't, he didn't know if we went out to dinner or not. He didn't know if he had eaten. He couldn't, he used to love to watch sports, but he couldn't follow the teams anymore. He couldn't remember the players unless they had been there a long time. And one thing that I always found just amazing and confusing, and so does Joey in the book, is I never could remember how my dad, he knew he couldn't remember, but I don't know how he remembered that.
I see your point. Wow, yeah. That's a level of self-awareness that you would think he couldn't possess. So right. It's really the short-term memory that's affected by this Lewy body dementia.
It was with my father. Memories. Yeah. Right. It definitely was. So it was only
he can recall the old murder or the old, yeah, the yes. old thing the dad can, but he doesn't have any idea what's going on in the current murder.
Correct.
Yeah. Which I think is an amazing twist. Actually, it's a very sad story, the old crime. So
yes.
I think Matt did that extremely well. And in fact, the whole book is amazing. It's really, really well done. Which I'm not surprised at, since I like the other books as well. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like this is a complete story. Do you have any other plans for Joey?
No, this is a standalone. So. Wrote it to be one book, and next summer's book is a standalone as well.
Yeah. Is it? So yes. You're going to give Nils a long vacation?
Well, I don't know. I do have a plan to bring him back, but it's not completely up to me. But I do have an idea for, and I've written more, I would say, mysteries than thrillers, but I do have an idea for a standalone Nils book that's a little more of a thriller than a mystery. So hopefully I'll get to write that someday.
Well, the good news is there's kind of a turn back towards more old-fashioned forms. I mean, there's a debut coming out here, which is a real noir PI novel and so forth. And, you know, publishing, as you know, runs in cycles. And,
yes,
you know, something is really popular and publishers love it and they want it. And then everybody does it and everybody gets bored. And then they want you to do something else. And, yeah. You know, and you just sort of stick around. But I find that the older, the classic forms don't really ever go away. And I think the private eye novels are a staple of crime fiction. And, you know, the moment I commented earlier this spring that the legal thriller had kind of fallen out of fashion. And then all of a sudden, you know, we get the Lincoln Lawyer and we get some inspiration. And now they're couple of legal thrillers that have popped up, a really good one by Joey Hartstone called The Loyal, which I liked a lot. And then there was another one by Robin Peguero in May. And so, you know, I don't lose hope, because I think the private eye novel will get a lot more interest again.
Yeah, I think private eyes and writers have a lot in common. They're kind of, we kind of feel like outsiders and truth tellers, sometimes having to go against the system. And that's often true in the private eye novels.
Well, you've had some wonderful critical success with this book, lots of very good reviews.
Yeah.
In fact, it was your starred review, I think, in Publishers Weekly that caught my eye and made me realize somehow inexplicably I had missed a Matt Goldman book, which is pretty rare for me, because normally when I follow an author, you know, I keep up.
Right.
So I think it was the paperback format that threw me. And I say that because what's happened, and it's not just Matt's publisher, but other publishers have started printing a small hardcover print run for library sales, they call it. And then a larger paperback that they think will do better at Barnes & Noble and other outlets. But they don't tell booksellers about the hardcover. Because they print them for libraries. And if somebody like me swoops in and grabs a whole bunch, there are fewer for libraries. And so that's what actually happened to me on this particular book. So
I see.
We were able to storm in there and collect enough hardcovers for one of our book collector clubs, because they require an autographed first print of a book. And so we did that, and it's our July book for our Notable New Fiction Club, but that's why we sold out.
Well, I know the paperback has already gone into a second printing.
Right.
So maybe they'll print some more hardcovers. Yeah.
Well, no, it won't do any good. Printing them doesn't help. I mean, you know, for
right.
for book collectors, you have to get there and get that printing one. So, but all I'm saying is
I see what you're saying.
The publisher doesn't want me as a bookseller to know there's a hardcover because they didn't print it for me. They printed it for library sales. And so it's become a little more of a challenge when I now see books. I have to really pay attention or go and explore to see if there's in fact a hardcover.
I'll give you a heads up next time.
Yeah. Well, now that I know, you know, right. that'll be fine. But it sort of caught me by surprise. But anyway, we have had a happy ending here. Right. So I'm glad that you feel like this has been such a success. What's going on in your TV career? Because I didn't mention that Matt is on a long and distinguished history as a screenwriter. Are you doing any work?
I'm not, and that's by choice. I have really fallen in love with novel writing and kind of set up my life to be able to continue doing that. I really enjoy my days. It suits my personality better. I have, you know, the mystery community, as you know, just the most wonderful group of authors and readers and booksellers and the libraries. And I really feel at home here. And I never quite did in TV. And I was lucky to have a great television career. And I worked with some amazing people. And I learned so much about story and character and dialogue. And I'm glad I did it. But I think this shift has been good for me.
Well, you wouldn't be a novelist you are if you hadn't had that previous writing experience. I think that, you know, one of your great strengths is dialogue, and obviously writing for a visual presentation is much more about dialogue than it is about internal monologue. And I'll say you've certainly mastered the art of dialogue because you're so good at it.
Oh, thank you. And I didn't learn how to write prose in TV. That's just from being a reader forever and really loving books. So,
well, there's a ton of classic crime that anybody who wants to write crime fiction can embrace, and you can learn a lot just from reading it.
Yeah.
Excuse me. One of the things that we noticed during the pandemic is that the sale of classics, not just crime fiction, but classics in general, really accelerated. I mean, you know, time to read War and Peace, or time to read Moby Dick or something. So we had a little tiny selection of classics, but during the pandemic it's like I don't know even how big it's gotten, but I see every week regularly now people are checking out, you know.
That's great news.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
but and so I think that particularly for people interested in writing in the mystery field, there's because structure is so important in a crime novel. You can't get away with just blathering along, you know, with no particular storyline. It doesn't work that way. It's probably one reason I like crime fiction so much, is that I really like story. But there are so many examples of it and how to structure it that you can sort of self-educate, you know, because you can read a lot of the classics yourself and figure it out.
Yeah, I don't think very much about structure when I'm writing. I just think don't be boring, you know, keep it moving. So, yeah,
it's hard to imagine because your books have all had really remarkable structure. Are you sure it's not subconscious from you from writing?
Oh, it is subconscious from me. That's exactly what it is. But I don't outline. I don't make a plan. When I start writing, there's a lot I don't know. Sometimes I almost don't know the whole thing. But I do, from working on over 500 episodes of television, I have developed an internal sense of story, and that's, you're exactly right. It is from my subconscious. I can feel when I'm getting off track, and I do know how to fix it because I was telling a young writer today, you know, in TV on a Monday, you go in with a script that's been worked on and worked on some more and worked on some more and rewritten for the studio and rewritten for the network and all these rewrites, and you think you have it perfect, and you bring it to the actors and you hear them read it around the table, and it stinks almost every time. And so you have days now to get it fixed. so you can shoot it on Friday. So doing that for decades really helped me learn story. I think dialogue came more naturally to me, character came more naturally to me, but I really had to learn story. And eventually I did, yeah.
Well, it's partly structure, it's also partly pacing, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want it to drag, and as Elmore Leonard famously says, you want to leave out the words that readers skip.
Yes.
And certainly writing for television or for movies is a lot more compressed. You can't digress. So it does
right.
teach you to cut the fat out. So you probably learned to self-edit pretty carefully too.
I did learn to do that. And I can't tell you how many times. I mean, it's in the triple digits that you write a script and you think it's perfect. And even sometimes you don't know it until you get into the editing room that we don't need that first scene. It's not, you can just take it away and then the story will be, it'll start better, it'll move faster. And so I try to incorporate that into my book writing as well.
Well, there are two things that I've learned over the course of editing hundreds of books. One is mm-hmm. that the writer has to get himself into the story. And so very often the first chapter or two of a novel turns out to be something you can cut because it was right. just the writer getting into it. But the other thing that, and you have to have, and I'm lucky I do, I think you have to have a really good memory as an editor, is that a writer, you're reading a book, in my case, a very short time, but let's right. say a day or something. The writer worked on it for, let's give him 8 months or something like
yeah.
that. And because of that, you start and you put it down and you come back to it and so forth, because inevitably you have to. And you forget as a writer that you've already said it. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you start again because you're getting yourself going. And so I found that most of the time, occasionally it was the other way around, where people failed to write down what was in their head. But right. most of the time, what happened was that there was a lot of repetition.
Yes.
Or, you know, they'd are, and so I found my job as an editor most of the time was to prune it, you know, and say, you already said this.
It's and a very again, important
trust
job.
Your reader, or trust your reader to remember it.
Yes.
And I think it's just the process of telling yourself the story as you're, you know, as you're working on it, staying in the story.
Yeah. And the role of an editor is very important because the writer needs that feedback, and they need it from someone who understands and believes in their voice. I say it like what I love about my editor, Kristen Sevick at Forge, is when she gets in the boat, she's rowing in the same direction as I am. And it makes all the difference in the world. And I rarely had that experience in Hollywood.
I can imagine that you didn't. And it's true. I mean, it's hard. And I didn't always do as well as I could have, but it's important for an editor to remember that it's your story, not the editor's story. And therefore, you know, the object is to help you tell your story and not the story the editor might wish you to be telling.
Right, right. And I do have that with Kristen. And I mean, she's the only editor I've had. This is, we're working on the sixth book now. But I feel her suggestions are minimal based on what I experienced in Hollywood. And she thinks I'm a great, like I'm a very receptive author because I guess some authors are not so receptive.
No.
One, her ideas are great. She's helpful and she's very respectful. She always says, this is your book, your name's on it, do what you feel is best. But we come from two extreme different places where we think each other is great. So it's nice, yeah.
Well, that's a nice partnership. I'm glad, you know, by staying in one house and having the same editor, you've got continuity that is not always true.
No, I know it's not always true. And who knows how long it'll last, but I hope it lasts a long time, yeah.
I hope it does too, Matt. Let's call Patrick up and see what Patrick might want to discover. Or whether there's been any comments or feedback or anything you'd like to say yourself, Patrick?
Well, let's see here. Yeah. Just looking at some of the comments that have come through. Belinda is just commenting about how much she liked the Audible version. Are you pleased with the way the audio turned out?
Very much so, yeah. And I've received a lot of wonderful comments from that. So you never know. I mean, I don't have to talk about TV too much, but I have so much experience casting actors that I feel very particular about who reads the books. So I feel fortunate. Yeah, I am.
Did you have input into that decision?
Yeah, Black. I don't know if Blackstone does it with everybody, but with but they give me veto power. So they'll send me three, and if I say, "Can I hear some more?" they'll send me a few more. But you know, they're pros at this, and they send me good people. So there's usually some good options to choose from. Mm. And they will read the first chapter of the book as an audition piece. And because there's some other voices that come later in the book, I wanted to hear some of those too. Right. So, yeah.
Laurel has a really good comment. She says, I found it refreshing that Joey sold costume jewelry and wasn't Mr. Award-winning architect, Mr. Financial Genius, or had some larger than life career. It's really interesting insight. She says that, it added to the realness of the story.
Oh, and that's nice.
She loved the book. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Mark, our friend, who's publishing it? Well, Forge, part of the Macmillan MPS group. Mm-hmm. Let's see here. What else? You've already addressed this. Russ says, Matt, the sense of place this book evokes is superb. The characters are terrific, especially Joey and Leela. Curious how you selected Louis body dementia as the dementia Marshall is afflicted with. And he's just asking what, you know, what kind of personal connection you had with that.
And just in case anyone's jumping in late, my father suffered from that. And I appreciate the comments about setting. I set it in Beaufort, a place I know. It's all part of using every bit of my life so I don't have to do a lot of research.
I mean, Beaufort is a very worthy place, though. I mean,
it is.
I've always been surprised there hasn't been more. You know, I tend to think, when I think of that part of the world, I tend to think like Pat Conroy or something, you know.
Well, that's where Pat Conroy's from. So readers, a lot of readers know Beaufort. And in fact, on my publication day, I did an event down there with the Pat Conroy Literary Center. Wonderful. which was an honor. Yeah. They really embraced the book, which was nice.
Let's see. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, I don't want to pick away too much personal stuff here, but I can only imagine that the experience of kind of going with your father through that, added to the emotional weight of the story. Are there a lot of very personal details that's made their way into the book?
There are a few in the book. The scene where Joey first realizes that his dad has a memory problem, I took pretty much verbatim from my life. And it was hard at times because I really, like, my dad is not Marshall Green. My dad wasn't a doctor. He didn't grow up in Beaufort. He just loved it there. It was my mom's side of the family that was from there. But I know, like, I have two brothers, and one of them had a hard time reading the book just because I wrote his voice.
Was he a World War II guy?
No, he wasn't that old. He was
Korea.
He would have been Korea, but he wasn't even. He was born in 35.
Okay.
So,
right.
So when I was born during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was on call for that in the Air Force, but so that's the age he was. He was lucky. He never saw combat. Yeah.
Despite your personal experience, did you have to do any kind of research into the details of this kind of dementia to get some of the language right, or some of the?
I did do some research into it. I have never claimed to be an expert on this. I just wrote my personal experience, but I did read Mayo Clinic and several other reputable websites about the disease, some of the terminology, how it progresses, and compared that to my experience with my dad.
There have been, and Barbara could chime in too. I mean, there have been an, I won't say a huge number, but there have been a few that deal with similar issues, you know, about the past being, mm-hmm. you know, the one I can think of just off the top of my head is Walter Mosley wrote a really nice, nice one called, oh gosh, something about Ptolemy Gray was the name mm-hmm. of the character. Mm-hmm. And there was like this, boy, talk about memory. I can't remember the exact plot, but right. there was something where this guy, he was in his 80s and was losing his memory fast. And there was a Faustian bargain that was made mm. where there was this real experimental drug that in 6 months it would kill him, but he would have six lucid months.
Oh, that's interesting.
Where he would have access to all of that, mm-hmm. you know. And Mosley did a not to talk about another writer's book, but just because
that's fine. It's a good writer to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see if anything else has come in.
Well, let me say, Patrick, as a corollary to that, crime fiction in the classic, you know, words cuts along the edge of social change. I mean, it's always been true that it wants to deal with that. And let's face it, we have an aging population, dementia, and related diseases, you know, Alzheimer, mm-hmm. Lewy body, whatever it might be. My grandmother had dementia from diabetes. I can't remember what it's called, but she mm-hmm. had little pinpoint strokes that people with diabetes can suffer from.
Yeah.
So her memory was affected by that. But it's becoming a bigger and bigger issue in society and the role of the caregiver and, you know, the implications of what somebody might do, you know, in that situation. I remember how upset everybody was when Robin Williams committed suicide. And then mm-hmm. when it was revealed that he had Lewy body dementia, everybody kind of went, well, okay, you know, there was, unfortunately, we can't understand Anthony Bourdain in the same way, you right. know. But I think a lot of it's people trying to make sense of that happening. A lot of it is people afraid it will happen to you. Mm-hmm. You know, a personal fear, but the whole toll on society, I think is there. And then, as we were saying earlier, it provides you with the opportunity to have an unreliable narrator or an unreliable actor in your yes. book, which, you know, takes away from the sort of amnesia thing that, you know, that's so prevalent.
Right.
That's really ingenious idea, you know, of having this past crime, you know, that's just out of reach in some right. ways, but is there, if you can just access it, and then having it influence the present, you know, with new crimes start to happen as mm-hmm. well, exactly. digging back into that. A really, really inspired concept.
Well, a lot it's of people an inspired are, book, I have yeah. to say. Are there any more questions?
I don't know, let's see. Just people chiming in saying how much they've liked the book, a great read on many levels. You just have some really nice fans here.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good to know. Well, you certainly have two very ardent fans here with Patrick and me, Matt. So I'm delighted that we had an opportunity to talk. I love Carolina Moonset. Now the paperback, as Matt pointed out, is available.
So, oh, one thing, Barbara, is that, you know, we have a customer who's kind of a famous musician named Nils Lofgren, who is plays for Bruce Springsteen's band. And I'll have to, next time he's in, I'll have to ask him. He'd probably be delighted to have a protagonist. I mean, not the current one, but of your other books named Nils, yes. which is the only yeah. one that I can think of in crime fiction, really.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think he's going back on the road. I think Springsteen is reviving in-person
band,
performance. Yeah. I thought for a long time that Arnulf here in Scottsdale was a drummer for no particularly good reason, but then I just heard he was really a guitarist. And he's very nice to me about it, proving, of course, that I haven't watched Springsteen.
Yeah, he's super nice. Super nice.
Oh,
man.
That's nice.
Yeah, yes, he's a lovely guy.
A great
and we've been
real,
lucky to have had him as a customer for so many years.
Guy too, real.
Yeah, he really is. Yeah. Anyway, Matt, it's been terrific. So let's plan on your next book coming out at a better time if you're for Scottsdale. Could we do that?
I'm going to make a call tomorrow.
All right. Yeah. Or we'll figure out
Barbara something. And Patrick, thank you so much.
It's really a pleasure. Thank you for this lovely book. And I hope everybody who's watching this has had a chance or will have a chance to read it. It's a perfect read for the 4th of July weekend coming up. So dash down to whatever your favorite bookseller is, if not us, and grab a copy. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
All right, thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.